Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. You are listening to RMU Radio, and this is Sports Takeover. Matt and Chris with you as always, so let's get started. The NFL Draft just took place this past weekend. We have a special guest to discuss it with us, my friend Henry, and draft fanatic he is, I might add. Henry Sutter's on the phone calling from Allegheny College. Henry, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. We hear that you're the draft guru, not quite Mel Kiper or Tom McShay, but the closest we can get for our radio show. So we're glad to have you for sure.
Yeah, thank you both very much.
All right, so let's just get right into the meat of the draft. It was one that the number one overall pick had been talked about throughout the year as it could be Nick Bosa, it could be an unknown quarterback, it really could have been any sort of defensive edge rusher. But then prospect of baseball, the Oakland Athletics turned football, Kyler Murray decided that he wanted to play professional football. He went number one overall. Matt, any thoughts on the whole Arizona Kyler Murray thing? You like it, dislike it, what?
Well, I know Henry has a unique perspective on this, and I look forward to him sharing that. But my original thought was that I did not like it. And the reason is as simple as this. They took Josh Rosen last year, which tells me that one of these two picks is an absolute waste of a pick. Obviously, Josh Rosen has been shipped out of town at this point, and we knew that he wasn't going to stick around as soon as this pick was made. But for me, I'm looking at a Cardinals team that is struggling at the moment. They're at the bottom of the NFL. And when you have these types of picks, you need to make them count. They've drafted two quarterbacks now in the last 2 years, obviously the first of which, like I said, shipped out of town. So it's tough to rebuild when you are starting an entirely new rebuild from year to year.
Yeah, absolutely. That seems like taking Josh Rosen, I thought last year was a reach. I thought he was the worst of the first round quarterbacks drafted. Now to give up on him so quickly shows that I don't even know why they decided to choose him. They're like, he's here. I guess we have to. I think Kyler Murray is the better quarterback between the two. I just find it so hard to see them just giving rid of Rosen so quickly. They ended up trading Rosen to the Dolphins for their second rounder. So they had no faith in him whatsoever. It was a very odd situation. I like the pick. I just don't like the whole circumstances surrounding the situation.
Yeah, Henry, why don't you share your perspective on that one?
This pick actually didn't surprise me whatsoever. As soon as I heard that Cliff Kingsbury got the hire in Arizona, I knew that they were going to probably go this direction. He had mentioned while at Texas Tech that he was really in love with Kyler Murray. He liked him as a pro prospect. And he said if he had the first overall pick as an NFL coach, he would take Kyler Murray. And so I think he's just a much better fit for this system than Josh Rosen would have been. I think that Josh Rosen was a bit of a reach last year with the pick, but I think they needed a quarterback. And had Kyler Murray not come out, I think they would have stuck with Josh Rosen. And I think they would have tried to make it work as best that they could. So I think the Kingsbury hire was ultimately what led to Kyler Murray being selected.
I think that's a really good point, that they kind of backed themselves into a corner in a way. My feeling, and I think I've talked to you both about this, is that I think Sam Bradford should have been the guy throughout the entire year.
Sam Bradford.
Simply because the Cardinals didn't have any expectations. Whether Sam Bradford goes and plays at a Pro Bowl level or at a backup level, the Cardinals weren't going anywhere last year. Why throw Rosen into the mix? Why, you know, put your coach in the hot seat after 1 year? I didn't understand that.
No, definitely. Sam Bradford is not a guy that I really care too much for. He is a former Heisman winner, former number one overall pick, but just the simple fact is that he is not the quarterback now that he was back then. But why they shifted between him to Rosen so quickly without letting Rosen develop, without just getting through the season, obviously they weren't going to be good. Number one overall pick indicates they were not good. So it was odd in the way they handled themselves last year, but they seem to look like they're on the right foot moving forward. And while we're on the topic of the Cardinals, I think they actually had one of the best drafts out of all 32 NFL teams. They got some solid players outside of the first round. They drafted Byron Murphy in the second round, who was many projected to be the Steelers' first round pick. He's a defensive back from Washington. They got Andy Isabella. I thought he was a first round talent. He was one of the best receivers in college this year at UMass, a little bit unknown. They got him in the second. And Hakeem Butler was a fourth rounder, and Deontay Thompson was a starting safety for Alabama. They got in the fifth round. So all those guys put together, I thought, was a very good package deal for the Cardinals.
Henry, what are your thoughts on the Cardinals draft, or what other team did you think had a good draft?
I thought the Cardinals did well. I think the Kyler Murray pick has to make sense because there's never a round where you take a quarterback of the future like the first round. And if you think that you have your guy at number one, then you have to go with whoever is there at number one. If you think Kyler Murray is ultimately going to lead your franchise to the Super Bowl promised land, then you have to take him at number one. But yeah, I think they did an excellent job picking up quality players that can fill in right away. The only thing I think they didn't address is their really poor offensive line. And so I think it's going to be tough for any quarterback coming in there to be successful.
Yeah, we saw David Johnson didn't do too great last year, coming off of an injury, of course. But still, if you don't have anyone to block for you, it's really hard to run. So yeah, definitely was one area they could have looked at. While we're on the topic of first-round quarterbacks, there's only three drafted this year. Daniel Jones went number 6 to the Giants, and Dwayne Haskins went number 15 to the Redskins. I thought the Giants made an absolute tremendous blunder taking Daniel Jones. He is just a prototypical white, large quarterback that is nothing better than Eli Manning and certainly is a strong reach at the number 6 pick. While I would prefer them to have picked Dwayne Haskins because he showed at Ohio State last year playing against stiff competition in the Big Ten. We saw they played Michigan, they played Michigan State. There was defensive players drafted from both of those teams. Haskins clearly was able to throw the ball around very well. So I was just surprised to see them gloss over Haskins. And good for the Redskins to let Haskins fall to 15. I mean, I don't think they intended on picking him, but seeing how he was still available at 15, you kind of just have to go for it at that point because you're not really losing anything, especially with the uncertainty surrounding Alex Smith, Colt McCoy, and the Redskins as a whole.
Yeah, I thought all signs pointed to Haskins going to the Giants. And for that reason, I think it's great that he went to the Redskins. You're looking at a guy who's got a chip on his shoulder now. He was passed up by a number of teams, one that it seemed would end up taking him. And that's the team that you get to play two times a year. So I think that's kind of exciting for him. And I think it'll be good for the Redskins. Henry?
For me, these were my highest and lowest valued picks in the whole draft. I think that Daniel Jones at 6, it doesn't really make sense because it's not like Daniel Jones wouldn't have been there at 17.
Exactly.
But if, like I said earlier, if you think you have your quarterback, you have to take them. You can't wait. And so if the Giants honestly thought Daniel Jones was the better player, you have to go ahead and take him. That's just where I think they were wrong. I don't think that Daniel Jones is near the prospect that Haskins was. And so I think for the Redskins, they had been tied to him. They had brought him in for pre-draft visits, and they were really hoping to be able to take him. But it was rumored that they didn't feel comfortable with the draft package they would have to send to move into the top 4 or 5 picks. And so for them to luck out and have him land all the way down at 15, I'm sure they're happy with that.
See, another team I thought that might be interesting in Daniel Jones was actually the Denver Broncos. They were at the 10, which if the Giants would have taken Haskins, I think they would have taken Jones at 10. However, because they didn't, they felt comfortable trading down to the 20 with the Steelers, ended up taking their white quarterback, Drew Lock, in the second round, another guy who I don't think has too much upside. We're talking about a guy out of Missouri and a guy in Daniel Jones out of Duke, neither of which are good schools. They're bad football schools right now as far as good schools are concerned in Power 5 conferences. So to see these two guys go both in the top 42 picks, I thought was very interesting. And meanwhile, Haskins is a guy, Ohio State obviously plays a top talent. Kyler Murray, obviously, at Oklahoma sees the best of the best in the Big 12. So these are guys that have seen good talent, but I think Denver and the Giants kind of dropped the ball a little bit on these guys.
I agree that Haskins would have been a good pick for them had they stayed at 10. The one thing I will say about Drew Lock, though, is he has time to actually develop. I think anymore we don't really see a future quarterback necessarily get drafted. You see guys who either are designed to be a backup, spend a couple years there and move on, or you see a guy who gets thrown into the mix immediately. And not saying that Joe Flacco is necessarily the answer for the Denver Broncos.
He's elite.
So I'm told. I think the fact that Drew Lock will be able to sit behind Flacco and develop for some time could be very beneficial to him and the Broncos.
I like the Drew Lock pick in the second round. If he had been a first rounder, I wouldn't have been as happy for it. But Denver really lucked out with this. I thought they made a huge mistake not taking a quarterback at 10, and then at 20, I thought maybe that's when they would take Drew Lock. But for them to get him in the second round and for him to be in an opportunity to sit for a few years, I think that really, if he has any chance of becoming a pro-style signal caller, that's going to be his best option, especially there with the Broncos. They are one of the few teams that could have taken a quarterback this year that have a team to actually build around a player.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like their defense is already set. We saw Philip Lindsay had a breakout season last year. Cortland Sutton, not so great, but definitely someone that can help grow with Drew Lock. And this year was really a quarterback weak draft. Last year we saw so many go in the first round, but in the first 133 picks there was only 7 quarterbacks drafted. After Drew Lock, Will Greer went at number 100 to the Panthers. Ryan Finley out of NC State went to number 104 to the Bengals, and Jarrett Stidham out of Auburn went at number 133 to the Patriots. So these guys clearly aren't going to be starters on any of the three teams I mentioned. They're just more backup role, maybe for the future, maybe an Aaron Rodgers type situation. But
maybe, yeah.
That, you know, these are stretches. Getting these guys in the middle shows, okay, we need a backup. It's not a bad time to get one. And if a guy gets hurt, I don't think it's a bad choice in these guys.
Yeah, so other top 10 picks. I think Nick Bosa was to be assumed at number 2. I think that one made sense. Cleveland Farrell, I think, surprised some people at number 4. Daniel Jones, we talked about. Josh Allen slides the whole way to the Jacksonville Jaguars at number 7. Tight end TJ Hockenson goes to Detroit at number 8 after they gave Jesse James some money in the offseason.
I think that's
Pittsburgh.
The worst pick of the first round.
And then Devin Bush after the Steelers trade up. What are your thoughts on those ones, Henry?
I assumed, like most people, that Nick Bosa would go. Cleveland Farrell, I was surprised by the pick. I wasn't really sure what the Raiders were doing there. But I have heard that Dabo Swinney has given his full marks on Cleveland Farrell and has said that he was the leader of that Clemson defense. And I don't think it's a bad pick. I think he's going to be a very good player for the Raiders. I was just surprised with his selection at number 4. Josh Allen, I mean, the Jaguars just build on that defense. I mean, if Nick Foles can't figure it out at quarterback, they're still in about the same position that they were last year. But that defense is going to be scary. And Hockenson doesn't really make sense to me with all of the needs that the Lions had. But it's not an awful pick because he is a good player. But I was surprised that they would go that route. Ed Oliver at number 9, that's one I think that we should really watch. I think he's going to be an impact player right away on that Bills defense.
Yeah, absolutely. Oliver was a guy that was talked about in the fall early on as being a top 3 pick, kind of slipped down the board throughout the year, but top 10 is nothing to be sad about. Farrell was one of 3 Clemson defensive linemen drafted in the first round, so that whole Clemson defense was just ridiculous. All sorts of talent all over the place, so I don't think it's bad picking him at 4. I think that Josh Allen would have made more sense. He seemed to be the more versatile player. Farrell was defensive end of the year in college, but Josh Allen won 2 different awards, I believe, the Butkus and another one, either way, for being just excellent at Kentucky. Clearly, the SEC faces strong schools. Clemson, we talked about a little bit in the fall, that they didn't have the strongest of schedules, but Kentucky saw the toughest of opponents, and Josh Allen played very well for all of them. So, yeah, and then TJ Hockenson, he's a good tight end, but taking a tight end at 8 is just so weird to me.
It's a stretch, yeah.
Because while you need a good tight end on your team, a tight end will not make or break your team. Yes, there's Rob Gronkowski, Travis Kelce, George Kittle. Those guys are excellent tight ends, but I don't believe any of them were first-round picks, let alone top 10 picks.
Yeah, I don't see Hockenson making that kind of a splash impact anyways. I don't see him being in the same conversation with those 3 guys. And so it is surprising. Sometimes teams will go the route of, well, he might be the best player available based on positional skill at this point. But I think need is a much, especially if you're drafting in the top 10, you really need to find positions of need rather than fancy skill players.
And talking about position of need, 2 centers that were chosen that I thought were excellent picks. The Vikings took Garrett Bradbury, a center at number 18. Their center from last year moved over to guard, bolster that offensive line for Kirk Cousins and Dalvin Cook, who clearly did not have the seasons last year that many wanted them to have. And then New Orleans did not have a first-round pick, so their first pick came in the second round at number 48. They traded up for center Eric McCoy from Texas A&M. Seeing how Max Unger kind of surprisingly retired in the offseason, that was clearly the largest need that the Saints needed to address, and by trading up to get their guy, I think will pave wonders for them. And it seems like centers, when they get drafted high, generally are as good as their draft position indicates. We saw the Pouncey twins now for Miami and Pittsburgh both doing excellent at their positions at center. So centers really, when they get drafted high, do well for these teams. So I thought the Vikings and the Saints hit the nail on the head with these 2 picks.
Yeah, Bradbury was one that I liked a lot. And those both fill needs for sure for their teams. Some other highlights throughout the draft. We talked about Drew Lock. I thought that was a solid one for Denver. Greedy Williams to Cleveland, I thought was very good for them.
I love that pick.
Miles Sanders to Philadelphia. Had a nice year with Penn State. He went at 53, so it's not, you know, breaking the bank to draft him, but I think that that's something that the Eagles needed. And DK Metcalf the whole way to 64 to the Seahawks.
He's talked about being top 10 potential.
Right, and that's a team that needs a wide receiver. So I think those are some other picks for me that I like throughout the draft.
Henry, any picks that stand out to you that we haven't mentioned yet?
To speak on DK Metcalf, I was surprised by his fall in the draft, but I was not as high on him as some other analysts were. I saw him perform at the combine, and he really showed out on drills like the 40-yard dash, and his bench press reps were impressive, but his three-cone drill and agility tests were comparable and actually slower than Tom Brady's in his draft.
Oh, good Lord,
And
Tom
so
Brady.
his lateral movement and ability to run anything other than the nine route, the go route, that's definitely in question. So I think he could be a good fit with Russell Wilson, but I think he's going to need to step out of the gym. That 1.6% body fat is not seemingly doing him any flexibility favors.
But the one good thing with him is, though, that you gave Russell Wilson this monster deal. Give him talent around him. Metcalf is certainly a guy, while he has some areas of concern, he can get down the field faster than most people on your team, and especially with the uncertainty surrounding Doug Baldwin's future, not too bad of a pick for the Seahawks at the end of the second round.
Absolutely not.
One more point I think to hit on here with the draft is close to home. The Pittsburgh Steelers, I thought, had a fantastic draft. Obviously, they traded up for Bush, first time that they've picked in the top 10 since 2000, so this is not something the Steelers do all that often. And then at pick 83, they got Justin Lane from Michigan State, cornerback. For me, those were the two big needs for the Steelers. After that, I didn't really care what they did, but they got a nice receiver at number 66, Benny Snell, running back. Not that they need a running back, but it never hurts to have that extra depth, and Benny Snell is a solid guy, and Zach Gentry, tight end out of Michigan, comes at pick 141.
See, my favorite pick actually was trading up for Devin Bush was excellent. We need an inside linebacker. Since Ryan Shazier's unfortunate injury, we have not had that playmaker there. Vince Williams is good, but he has as much speed as Cam Hayward does, so he can't cover. Devin Bush is a guy, he can cover, he can rush, he can play the run, he can play the pass, he can do anything you ask him to do. He's going to be an every down kind of guy. Great pick there. Justin Lane was a guy many people touted as second round talent, ended up falling to the third round, so the Steelers said, please, thank you, I will take you here since you're here. He's 6'2 at cornerback, so he can match up with receivers very well. I like that pick a lot. Benny Snell, you said we don't need running back. Well, we have James Conner and Jalen Samuels, and I believe we both saw the same New Orleans Saints game where Stephen Ridley fumbled the ball. So if we can get depth at running back, it is certainly a primary concern, especially in a league where running backs seem to go so fast. You see, like, teams have four running back committees just because it's a tough position now. It's not the same as it was 10 to 15 years ago. You need that much talent there. Another pick I liked a lot was fifth or sixth round. It was Isaiah Bugs. He's a defensive end out of Alabama. He started every game for Alabama. Clearly, he was not one of the best players in their defense, but he was a leader on their defense. And getting him as a backup depth at defensive end is good, seeing how after Tyson Alualu, we really don't have many players there. What are your thoughts on the Steelers' draft, Henry?
I think all of those picks that we mentioned so far have been really important, but I don't think we should sleep on the sixth one of the sixth round picks, so Sutton Smith from Northern Illinois. He actually comes into this draft over the last 2 seasons having the most sacks in college football. He's a little bit of an undersized guy. He's going to struggle probably to get into the rotation early on, but I think with some development, he could definitely turn into a pass rusher, at least situationally.
Yeah, I definitely didn't know there was a guy at Northern Illinois who led in sacks the last 2 years, so that's
That's
good.
why we have you on the show. That's the stuff we're looking for right there.
Any lasting impressions from the draft, Henry, that you'd like to include?
I thought the Steelers did well also with that third round pick, the receiver, Deontay Johnson. I think drafting another receiver from the Mid-Atlantic Conference after Mr. Big Chest's Antonio Brown's departure, I think maybe going out and getting a smaller, faster route running kind of blue chip prospect from Toledo is going to help out that receiver core. Maybe bringing in somebody else who has that initial chip on their shoulder and can bring a few years of production.
Yeah, besides the Lima Swede pick several years ago, I think the Steelers have done it very well at drafting receivers. So this guy, a little bit unknown out of Toledo, but Antonio Brown was even more unknown out of Central Michigan, so we saw what he turned into there. So definitely a pick to look out for.
I think the draft overall was success for a lot of teams. I think we had a lot of picks here that we liked. Obviously, some that we questioned a little bit, but for the most part, I think there's a lot of good guys coming out of this draft. Henry, thank you very much for taking the time to join us tonight. We appreciate everything that you brought to the table for us. Look forward to having you on the show again at some point.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me on.
All right, that was Henry with our NFL draft coverage. Now we move on into the NHL, where second round of the playoffs It's progressing along, but it's not too far in depth. Most series, I believe, are still at 3 games or 4 games. So can I give us some quick series updates, Matt, here? Where are we looking at?
Well, we got 2-1s all over the place just about. Boston and Columbus, that's 2-1 in favor of the Blue Jackets, who are still finding a way to win hockey games somehow in the playoffs. They're playing their first game in May in franchise history in Game 4.
Incredible.
I would agree with that. Also in the East, the Islanders and Hurricanes, that's 2-0 in favor of Carolina. They are in action as we speak. Western Conference, both series are 2-1. San Jose over Colorado and St. Louis over Dallas.
Yeah, definitely some close series here. No sweeps this round, thankfully, after the...
You never know. Carolina?
No, Matt.
It's out there. It's possible.
But highly unlikely. Either way, it seems to be much closer series. The Colorado-San Jose is really close. St. Louis and Dallas are really close. Honestly, Carolina, while they've won both games, they've both been extremely close games. So they could go down to the wire. Who's to say? But one thing that's going down to the wire right now, it's award season, ladies and gentlemen. While we won't be able to cover it whenever they actually get announced, we are going to make our picks now as the finalists for a multitude of categories have been announced. So I will start on the defensive end at the Norris Trophy, and I will go with defenseman Mark Giordano out of Calgary. He had 17 goals and 57 assists this year, second in points for defensemen, was a plus 39 that led the entire league, and Calgary was eighth in goals against. He put up a career year. He's about 36 or 37 years old. Definitely kind of came out of nowhere. He's been a solid defenseman for a while, but to do as well as he did this year, I don't think anybody would have thought that. So he had my Norris pick.
That's a really good one, but I'm going to go with Brent Burns. The man had 83 points as a defenseman. That's insane to me. Plus 13, averaged just over 25 minutes on the ice per game. He's just such a difficult player to match up against in any way, shape, or form. The things he's able to do, unmatched virtually by any other defenseman. And Erik Karlsson, who is a huge acquisition for them, missed a decent amount of time.
About the last 2 months of the season.
Yeah, large chunk of the season to injury. So Brent Burns was the guy, as he has been for a lot of the season, and boy, did he deliver.
Okay, definitely a good pick there. I think that one's a very tight race.
I agree.
Victor Hedman's the third runner or nominee. I don't think he has any shot, though. I think it could...
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of our two
definitely
guys.
Between those. But it's not clear-cut this time, which I like, so be keen to see how that works out. Moving to the goalie side now, for Vezina, I'm going to go with Ben Bishop of the Dallas Stars. While he did miss some time this year, he still went 27-15-2, had a .934 save percentage, which led the league, 1.98 goals against, which was second in the league, and 7 shutouts, which was third in the league. Dallas knew they needed a goalie whenever they got Bishop a few years back. They thought he was going to be the guy that he clearly was this season. A big reason why they're still playing in the playoffs. For me, he's the Vezina for sure.
He's mine as well. Those numbers are sensational. And not only are they good for him, but Dallas struggled offensively, which is something that they don't usually do. And they got into the playoffs because of their defense and because of Ben Bishop. And the one stat that blew me away that you didn't mention, he had a shutout streak this year of 233 minutes and 4 seconds.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. That's incredible.
That's a lot. It's almost 4 straight games.
Yes, it is. It's insane. Yeah, I agree. Ben Bishop is my winner for the Vezina.
Okay, and so that's our goalie pick. I have another goalie pick, actually. That's going to come for the Calder, and that is going to be the Rookie of the Year, which I will put to Jordan Binnington out of St. Louis. From the moment he stepped into the league, it was pretty much his league to own. He went 24-5-1. 24 wins in 30 games is ridiculous enough. Had a .927 save percentage and 1.89 goals against. That was first in the league. Oh, in his 30 games, he had 5 shutouts. So every 6 times he stepped on the ice, he shut out the opposing team. He's, in my opinion, the only reason why St. Louis is in the postseason. Without him, they don't make the postseason, let alone win the first round. So he clearly is my pick for Calder, because many people thought it could have been Elias Pettersson. He was good this year, had 66 points with the Canucks, but the Canucks aren't playing right now. The Blues are. Binnington is the reason why he is the Calder for me.
Boy, you took the words right out of my mouth. It's Binnington for me as well, for all of the numbers that you listed, but especially because you're right. He's the reason that the Blues are in the playoffs. The Blues had nothing going for them before Jordan Binnington stepped in the crease, and now they're in the second round. Playoffs don't factor into this, but regardless, he got them to the postseason. Rasmus Dahlin and Elias Pettersson were both fantastic in their own right. but their teams finished nowhere near the postseason. Bennington single-handedly, in my opinion, single-handedly got the Blues to the playoffs. For me, Calder's Jordan Bennington.
Absolutely. Moving ahead to the Ted Lindsay, that's the most outstanding player as voted by the players. I'm going to choose Connor McDavid for this one. He put up 41 goals and 75 assists. And besides Leon Draisaitl, who actually put up a 50-goal season, which blew me away because he had a bad year last year, Connor McDavid is the only player that can step on the ice for the Oilers and make an impact every single night. That team is just a dumpster fire. We've talked about it before. Their GM and front office have no idea how to operate. Clearly seeing how their GM was fired earlier this year, their coach was fired. Connor McDavid knows how to play hockey. He can do it better than almost every single player in the world. He averaged 22 in minutes and 50 seconds of ice time, which is unheard of for forwards. Most forwards average, somewhere around 18, 19 minutes on the first line because that's a third of the game. He is playing over a third of the game because nobody else can get it done for Edmonton, so he is my most outstanding player.
For me, it's Nikita Kucherov. The season he put together is arguably the best in probably 20 years. His point total was, anyway, he had 128 points. He had 87 assists. A couple years ago, Jamie Benn won the scoring title for points with 87.
Yeah, that's
and Kucherov
bad.
Knocked that out with assists this year. You can say what you want about who else is on that Tampa team and what other talent is surrounding him, but I mean, he kind of blew everyone out of the water this year and in recent years. And for me, he was the most outstanding player this year, Nikita Kucherov.
Moving ahead to the Selke that is best defensive forward, I'm going to go with Ryan O'Reilly of the St. Louis Blues. Had a career for the Blues in his first season with the team. Had a 56.9 faceoff percentage, which was extraordinarily well. Anytime you can go in the faceoff circle and win more than half the time, your team will love it. A very interesting stat I found, while he was on the ice for even strength, his team had a 934 save percentage, which that would have put them, that's the best save percentage in the league Ben Bishop had. So whenever you can match that by being on the ice, that is excellent in your own right. Only 12 penalty minutes, so he is a guy that will put in time for your team and not be taking stupid penalties. And he was also a plus 22, which was insane. So Ryan O'Reilly is my Selke winner for sure.
So I have Patrice Bergeron, but I don't think that you can go wrong with any of these three guys. I think all three of them are very deserving, equally deserving. I like the numbers that you brought up about Ryan O'Reilly. Those are numbers I had not found, and I think that those are very convincing. Patrice Bergeron had 4 shorthanded goals, 60 blocks, and was 8th in the league in faceoff percentage. So obviously this is a guy who's nominated, I believe, for a record 8th consecutive time. Won it 2 years ago, most recently. He finds himself here every year. And for that reason, I think reputation could be the reason that he wins the award. But regardless, I think performance-wise, all three of these guys, very deserving, very easily could win, but I'll say Bergeron.
Yeah, definitely one that could go anyway, so I can see how that one develops. Moving ahead to Lady Bing, I'm going to go with Alexander Barkov. He is consistently touted as one of the most underrated players in the league, but he should be rated as well as he is because this year he had a career year, had 35 goals, 61 assists, good for 96 points, best in Florida Panthers history. 8 penalty minutes. That's 4 minor penalties. That's insane. And I mentioned Connor McDavid's ridiculous ice time. Alexander Barkov had 22 minutes and 21 seconds, so he only plays on average one less shift a game than McDavid does. He is just outstanding, does everything good for the Panthers, definitely a cornerstone for any NHL franchise, but he's my Lady Bing this year.
He's mine as well. And again, you took the words right out of my mouth. The penalty minutes are down. The points are up in a huge way. His contribution to the Panthers is unbelievable, and Lady Bing is most gentlemanly player, but also matched with performance, with skill. And he brought both of them in a big way, and he's my pick as well for the Lady Bing.
Yeah, you can be a gentleman and score 5 goals, or you can be a gentleman and get 96 points. Alexander Barkov clearly did the latter half. Moving ahead, the Masterson, that is Perseverance. I'm going to go with Joe Thornton. He's 39. He looks like he's about 59. His beard has been gray for years. Last year, he tore his ACL and MCL in his left knee, and he managed to overcome that to come back this season to put up 51 points as a third-line center. Not too bad in that regard, so he is my Masterson pick.
Yeah, he's mine as well. Again, in the playoffs, not that this factors in, but what he's still able to do at his age for as long as he's been around is fantastic. You mentioned that he kept it up in the regular season as well. He may not be the captain of that team, but he leads that Sharks team, and what he's able to do is incredible. I think anytime you see guys play at this level for as long as they do. They showed a graphic of him the other night, the age of his line mates when he made his debut, and I want to say they were somewhere along the lines of 3 and 5.
Yeah,
so that gives you an idea. Not only is he doing it at this age, but he's been doing it since he was 18 years old, so he's my pick as well.
Yeah, definitely a good one there. Moving into the front office now, going to go to the Adams, which is the coach of the year. I'm going to go with Barry Trotz. In his first year with the New York Islanders, he took them to the playoffs, a place they had not been a few years. They went from last year in the league in goals against to first. That is a remarkable triumph. They won a playoff series. They swept the Penguins. Once again, playoffs don't factor in, but we're not the committee, so they can factor into our decisions. He led the Islanders to a sweep over the Penguins, which is remarkable. Just the fact that he can implement his style of defense, which worked so many years for Washington leading up to their Stanley Cup last season, now to move to the Islanders, which clearly does not have the skill players, especially when you factor in the fact they lost John Tavares. And what he can do with the team he had was just incredible. He's my Jack Adams Coach of the Year for sure.
This might have been the easiest decision for me of any of the awards, and it is Barry Trotz for me as well. The Islanders were dead last in defense last year. They were first in defense this year. They were only the second team ever to do that, and they were the first since the Ottawa Senators in, I want to say, 1917, 1918.
A time that makes no difference to me and you.
Not even the same Ottawa Senators that we're seeing now, so it's an incredible feat. 23-point increase to get them to the postseason after John Tavares left, and we're left thinking that the Islanders are going to be the laughing stock of the NHL. He pulls them into the postseason. I think that's fantastic, and I think that easily Barry Trotz should win the Jack Adams.
Still in the front office, moving over to GM of the year, I'm going to go with the Maple Leafs, Kyle Dubas. He signed John Tavares in the offseason, which was probably the biggest offseason signing that there was in the NHL, to a large contract to play in his hometown. He put up 40 goals for the team, so clearly that worked out. Signed William Nylander after having some sort of contract issue with him, got him back on the team. Good for the Leafs moving forward. He's a good young talent that they need to have. And also made the big trade for Jake Muzzin, which was pretty much the first trade at the deadline to happen. So for all those reasons, I think Kyle Dubas did what he could to get the Maple Leafs to the position they are in. Whether the players decided to listen to what he was doing for their team is a different story, but he did all that he could in his power to get them here.
I'm going to go with George McPhee from Las Vegas.
2 years in a row?
Yes, because I'm just that impressed by the Vegas Golden Knights. We've seen expansion teams in the past be horrible for a long time, and Columbus is one of the most recent expansion teams. They were in 2000. They just won their first playoff series. What he has Vegas doing is incredible, and of course, what he did last year doesn't necessarily factor in, but what he's done this year, he added Paul Stastny in the offseason to bolster the offense, and then he made the trade for Mark Stone at the deadline. So what he's done to form this team, to build it from literally nothing, is incredible to me. But the fact that, I mean, he's still taking advantage of what he set himself up to do. He set himself up. He's executing on it well. George McPhee, Vegas Golden Knights, is my pick for the GM of the year.
And last but not least, the MVP award, the most valuable player in the league. I know we're going to differ on this one. I'm going to go with the guy you said for the Lindsay Award. That is Nikita Kucherov. 41 goals, 87 assists. Just, it's unheard of the numbers he was able to do. While I think Tampa Bay is clearly a playoff team without him, they do not win the President's Trophy without him. They do not get, I don't think they'd be the best team in the Atlantic. I think Boston would have been the best team in that division. Yes, they would have made the playoffs, maybe even won a series, but once again, playoffs don't matter to this. It's the regular season, and what Nikita Kucherov did was just insane. Most points a player has had since 95-96 season. He put this team on his back, helped Braden Point and Steven Stamkos have career years. For that reason, I think Nikita Kucherov is most valuable to his team.
So here's the thing. To me, the MVP is not determined the way it should be in any league, not just the NHL. MVP is most valuable player, most valuable to their team, not the best player. And I think that those two often get confused. Easily, Nikita Kucherov is the best player. He's my pick for MVP because I think that's just the way that it's going to work out. But when I look at the three finalists, Connor McDavid, to me, should not be in the running for MVP. Not because he had a poor season, because he didn't, he was fantastic, but because his team didn't get in. To me, when half of the teams in the league get in, you cannot be the most valuable player to your team if they don't at least get to the playoffs. So for me, it's not McDavid. To me, it could be Crosby. It won't be Crosby. He will not win. Kucherov will win. But it could be Crosby because, to me, the Penguins struggled all season. Ups and downs. Crosby cracks 100 points. without Sidney Crosby playing at the level that he played, the Penguins maybe don't get in. Maybe,
I don't think they do.
Maybe they squeak in as a wild card, but I think it's very possible that they don't get in. To me, if we're looking at MVP literally as most valuable player to your team, no one is more valuable to their team this year than Crosby, because he was the difference, I think, between the Penguins getting in and missing the playoffs. However, you're right, Kucherov, they don't win the President's Trophy without him, probably don't win the division without him. It's a whole different season for Tampa Bay without Kucherov. Kucherov will win this award.
That is our predictions for the NHL Awards. That ceremony will be in June. After we're done with the show, we'll keep up with it on social media to see how our picks turned out. For now, though, we're going to take a quick break, but coming up, we have NBA award winners and then a summer preview and the rest of the show, so please stay tuned.
A tornado flew around my room before you came. Excuse the mess it made. It usually doesn't rain in Southern California, much like Arizona. My eyes don't shed tears, but boy, they pour when I'm thinking about you. Oh, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. You, no, no, no. I've been thinking about you. Do you think about me still? Do you, do you? Or do you not?
Welcome back to Sports Takeover, Matt and Chris. We're going to shift gears from the NHL playoffs and awards to NBA playoffs and awards. So just to recap what we have in the playoffs so far in round two, we said the NHL was early. Well, it's even earlier in the NBA. Both series in the East, Milwaukee, Boston, Toronto, Philadelphia, are at 1-1. In the West, Golden State is up 2-0 on Houston, and Denver is up 1-0 on Portland. So very early going there, fairly even. With the exception of Golden State.
Well, the Warriors and Rockets two games, though, were both close games. It was single-digit victories by the Warriors.
This is true.
Extremely close. It should be a good series. The Rockets need to win next two at home if they want to have any chance in this series. But definitely close games there. Milwaukee and Boston was surprising that Milwaukee dropped the first one to Boston at home. But what was even more surprising to me was while being only up by 5 at halftime in Game 2, Milwaukee ended up winning Game 2 by about 20 points, and they had a 30-point lead at one point in the second half. So I don't know how that series is going to play out, but it should be exciting. The Raptors and the Sixers, even as it comes, the Sixers barely won Game 1, Raptors barely won Game 2. Both these teams are kind of unfamiliar moving ahead. They don't get there very often. Raptors maybe a little more than the Sixers, but definitely exciting there. And Portland and Denver, way too early to tell anything because NBA likes to schedule games 3 days apart for whatever reason.
4 days apart in some cases.
Yeah, we saw last night after the Warriors game was over that they don't play again until Saturday. So it's just a slow schedule, but either way, still too early to decide what's going to happen in these series. But once again, it's not too early to decide what's going to happen in the award season. Once again, we won't be here to announce who actually wins the awards, but that won't stop us from making our picks. So I will start with Defensive Player of the Year. While nominees have not been announced yet, we can make our own nominees because that's the liberties we have of doing this show.
Yeah, that's the fun of it.
So I'm going to go with Giannis Antetokounmpo of the Milwaukee Bucks. Had a .179 defensive win share, which means that he helps his team. That was like third in the league. It's just a really good defensive stat. Had 10.3 defensive rebounds per game and 1.3 steals per game. Milwaukee was the best team offensively and defensively. Defense was spearheaded by him, so he's my pick.
Okay, I think mine could be a little bit of a stretch, but I'm going to go with Andre Drummond from the Pistons. He averaged 10.2 defensive rebounds per game, averaged 1.7 blocks per game, 1.7 steals per game. So I think from what I saw, a lot of guys have numbers higher than that in one of the two categories, blocks or steals. But to me, he was consistent in both. Overall, defensively, solid numbers for Andre Drummond. Big part of what the Pistons are doing in Detroit. So Andre Drummond is my pick for Defensive Player of the Year.
His defense helped get the Pistons there. Paul George is another guy we didn't mention. He's definitely
up
for contention. So it should be exciting to see that one. Rookie of the Year, I think it's pretty clear cut. For me, it's Luka Doncic of the Dallas Mavericks. He had 21.2 points per game, 7.8 rebounds, 6 assists, and played 32 minutes a game too. Just took Dallas by storm. His European style is just something that a lot of these American players are not familiar with. While one European, Dirk Nowitzki, will no longer play for the Mavericks, it looks like it's Luka's team for the next 20 years if he desires. So he is my pick for Rookie of the Year.
I'm glad that you said his name first so that I could make sure that I said Doncic the way I was supposed to. But again, I think you're looking at my notes over here. You took the stats right off my paper. It's incredible. I agree. I thought looking at the numbers, looking at the performance throughout the year, he is pretty clearly the favorite for Rookie of the Year. So Luka is my choice as well.
Trey Young's another one up there, but the Hawks suck. The Mavericks also suck, but Luka seems to be a good player moving forward. Had triple doubles, and he did this all mostly while being a teenager. He only turned 20 during the season, so he's young with a lot of potential. A guy that maybe is a little bit older with a little bit less potential, but definitely has the results, is my Sixth Man of the Year award winner, which will go to Lou Williams. Off the bench, he had 20 points per game on average, 3 rebounds, 5.4 assists, and 26 minutes. So he was playing over half the game off the bench, which is interesting because Miles will make him a star at that point, but he seems to have the whole come off the bench roll down really well if he can average 20. So for that reason, I have Lou Williams.
I have Lou Williams as well. One number that you actually didn't steal off my paper, I don't think. 5.1 was his win shares.
I do not. That's a good one.
That's a pretty solid number for a guy coming off the bench. You said it. He plays a lot of the minutes in the game for a sixth man, but to me, that's all the more reason to make Lou Williams the Sixth Man of the Year.
And he's definitely a consistent bench player. He's been up here in contention or winning the award for about the last 5 years, so he is no stranger to this category. Most Improved Player, I think, is one that has a lot of freedom because in your opinion, in my opinion, in anybody's opinion on what improvement means is very out there. For me, it's Derrick Rose. He is a guy that basically blew up his whole leg and his whole career. He was a guy that was an MVP award winner for the Chicago Bulls, got sent to the Knicks, kind of squandered anything there, moved to the Cavs. Now he's in Minnesota where he is doing extraordinarily well. Had 18 points per game, 2.7 rebounds, 4.3 assists, 27 minutes. So he's playing over half the game as well. 482 field goal percentage, second highest ever in his career. 37% from three, that's the highest ever in his career. This is overall his best season he's had since the 2011-2012 season. He averaged 18 with the Knicks in one of his seasons, but if you encompass all of his stats together, this is the best season he's had in about 8 years. Just for the guy that seemed to be so far away to come back and do so well this season, he is my most improved player.
I didn't think we would agree on this one.
Really?
But we do. I have Derrick Rose as well.
I
yeah.
love it.
Obviously, the numbers you mentioned, again, taking them off my paper, but his numbers last year, 8.4 points per game, 1.5 assists, and 1.4 rebounds. So that alone tells me that just from last year, this is an incredible step in the right direction for him. But you mentioned it as well, long term as well. He's back. Compared to what we've seen in recent years, he looks more not like the Derrick Rose that won the MVP award, but more similar to that than the Derrick Rose that we've seen bounce around between the Knicks and the Cavaliers for like 16 games. So Derrick Rose is my pick as well for most improved.
Yeah, he's certainly a good point guard to have on a team right now. Hopeful that Derrick Rose can continue this in the future. He's a guy I like to see win. Moving into the front office, I'm going to go start with Coach of the Year. I'm going to go to the Milwaukee Bucks. Mike Budenholzer, I believe is how you pronounce his name. This is his first season with the Bucks. He was previously with the Hawks, and all he did was lead the Bucks to a 60-22 record, which was best in the NBA. Back to the postseason, led them to a playoff series victory. He just is doing everything right. He knows how to organize his team so well. He is my Coach of the Year for that reason.
My Coach of the Year is going to be Michael Malone from the Denver Nuggets. Good for second in the West. 54 wins. I was only three behind the Golden State Warriors. The Denver Nuggets are not a team that's had much success recently, really since Carmelo Anthony left, you could argue. So the fact that they were not only finished second, but they were competitive with Golden State the entire season.
Yeah, they were up there.
I believe
all the way
at
to
one point
end.
You called it that they would take that top seed by the end of the season.
It was
a
one-game difference, I think, in April.
Yeah, and it, like I said, it ended at a three-game difference, so it was very close throughout the entire year. Good for him to get Denver up there, and especially in a very competitive Western Conference. Not any knock on your pick, the Bucks excelled in fantastic ways in that Eastern Conference, but the West was tough, and he got the Nuggets up to number two, so Michael Malone is my pick.
Yeah, and also Denver, first playoff series victory in 10 years, so I think both these guys you mentioned, excellent picks, both did well for their teams. Executive of the Year, I guess this could be president or GM or basketball operation man. I don't know what position it's exactly for. That's why it's generally as executive. I'm going to go to the Philadelphia 76ers and Elton Brand. He took a Sixers team which was trusting the process for so many years. Last year made the postseason, did well, but not exactly well enough. Well, the process is even better this year because they acquired Jimmy Butler, Tobias Harris, and Boban Marjanovic. All three of these guys have helped the Sixers do extremely well. In a post-game interview the other night, the Sixers coach called Jimmy Butler. This wasn't Jimmy on the court tonight, it was James. Well, his name's actually Jimmy, so that was a little bit of a irrational comment there. But for Elton Brand to bring all these players onto the Sixers team, yes, they were trusting the process, but they needed the extra piece to get ahead of the Raptors and Bucks. I think these guys are great, and Elton Brand's just, it's interesting to see a guy that was a forward in my lifetime. I knew him back about 5-10 years ago when he was still playing, to now be a GM for one of these teams. It's really a transfiguration, so he is my executive of the year.
I tricked you. See, I had his name written down. You stole it off my paper, and then I changed it.
Is that how that worked?
That's exactly how it worked. I'm going to go with the Toronto Raptors and Masai Ujiri. Don't know if I said that right, but that's who I'm going
to
go with.
Sounds good to me.
Big acquisitions, like you talked about, Kawhi Leonard coming over in the offseason.
That's huge.
Could be the biggest move that any team has made. And then they add, I believe, Marc Gasol, correct?
Yes.
Added Marc Gasol, who's a fantastic defensive player, solid with the Grizzlies. I think those are two guys that can really get them to the next level, especially this year when the East is so wide open, to make those kind of moves to position yourself, and they did. They positioned themselves as the number two seed in the East, currently going against Elton and those 76ers. So I'm going to go with Masai Ujiri of the Toronto Raptors.
Yeah, Kawhi Leonard is my favorite player in the league. I think getting him on this team shows the Raptors, all right, LeBron's gone, let's get it done. Definitely interesting to see who can win that one. And the last award that will be very wide open, been much discussed all season, is Most Valuable Player. For me, it's James Harden of the Rockets. He put up 36.1 points per game, which is just, it's unheard of to average that much. He had, I believe, a 30 or so game streak where he scored at least 30 points in every game. It was insane. He had 6.6 rebounds, 7.5 assists, and the one stat I love, 2 steals a game. When you can have a guy that can score on offense, he gets touted as not playing defense, but if he's getting 2 steals a game, clearly he's getting the ball into his hands. It's a very stiff competition between him and Giannis, but I think that James Harden is the only reason why the Rockets got to the playoffs as well as they did, because the West is so competitive, and he just took his team to the next level with his play, put the team on his back, said, this is my team, I got it. James Harden's my MVP pick.
You said his name, Giannis, that's who I'm taking from the Milwaukee Bucks. And again, this kind of comes back to me looking at MVP, I think, differently than a lot of people do. What James Harden has been able to accomplish this year is incredible, and certainly he's very deserving of this award. But for me, the Milwaukee Bucks, top of the Eastern Conference, big reason was Giannis Antetokounmpo, 27.7 points per game, 12.5 rebounds per game, 5.9 assists. He was just incredible, and I don't think, although the West is more competitive, I don't think the Bucks have the success that they do in that top tier of the Eastern Conference without him. So for me, that's my MVP.
Those are our picks for NBA awards. We're going to shift focus now. Can I do another preview segment? This is our last show for this school year. We will be back again at the end of August. So what is to happen during the summer? Well, that's what this preview will encompass. So a lot of different things sport-wise to happen this summer. NHL and NBA Finals will be wrapping up in early to mid-June. Of the NHL teams, 8 of them remaining, 5 of them have won a cup, 3 of them have not. So, and the last one was in 2011, so definitely going to be a newer face there. NBA probably going to see the Warriors versus some team from the East. I would love to see somebody else, but that's most likely what the NBA is going to look like. We saw Tiger win the Masters, first major of the season. There are 3 more majors to be had. All will happen this summer, May, June, July. If he's able to win another one of those, that will be monumental. I don't know if he has it in him, but definitely will get people to be watching, and I certainly will be looking out there.
It's going to be very good golf tournaments, regardless of whether or not Tiger is able to pull them out. Wimbledon, obviously, will be happening at the beginning of July.
Tennis, yes.
Tennis, the biggest tennis event of the year, I would say.
I would agree.
So that'll be at the beginning of July. A little bit less than a week after Wimbledon begins, the Tour de France will take place. That's going to start on July 6th, so a little bit of cycling in there for you as well.
Everybody loves some good cycling. 2019, it's been 4 years since the last Women's World Cup, so we're going to get it again this summer. It will be in France. 24 teams will flock there to that country from June 7th through July 7th. U.S. is the defending champion. They probably are the favorites. I don't follow women's soccer extensively, but the U.S. women seem to be consistently at the top. Japan was the team they defeated last time after being defeated by them in 2011. Should be exciting to see who's able to come out from that one. In the MLB, it'll be about 80% done with the season, so the playoff picture will not be set, but it will certainly be, I would say, 90% shaped up. There will be probably wild cards to be chosen, but for as wide open as it has been so far, I think some of these teams at the top will start to fall off, and the true candidates will obviously rise by the time we get back.
Yes, 162 games, and a large chunk of them will be while we are not here, so MLB will certainly begin to take shape. The NFL will also take shape in a way. Preseason will be underway. Training camp will be concluded. Obviously, the draft and free agency have passed, but obviously we'll see teams back in action and getting ready for the regular season by the time that we return.
Yeah, so while we won't be here, those events will be happening in the summer. Do you have any lasting ones to include?
I think that's it for me, the big ones anyway. Of course, you've got other more random ones that you just never know what you might find.
Indy 500, various NASCAR, Monster Energy Cup Series races, for those racing fanatics, including myself, Champions League final, all of the soccer leagues will conclude.
The World Championships of Handball.
Yeah, got a good list over there?
I apologize. That's a little bit farther on. We will be back for that. But yeah, again, you just never know what you're going
to
find.
Expect us to cover Handball World Championships if we come back. That's what I'm hearing from Matt. Either way, long summer ahead of us. One last iteration of quick picks, though, that we can get in for this year. It will be in the playoffs. We will start with the NHL. Boston travels to Columbus for a pivotal game 4. I don't see Boston going down 3-1 to Columbus in the series. I don't see Columbus winning another game in the series personally. So for that reason, I will go with the Bruins to tie the series at 2-2 and be able to ride that wave into their next 2 victories.
Before I make my pick, I'm going to have to point out that the season 1 quick pick title is almost, it's all but clinched.
It's not mathematically clinched, but essentially clinched.
If my math is correct, Chris currently sits at 98-77, a very solid record for the uncertainty that there is in quick picks.
I'll take it.
I am sitting at 105-70, which means that the only way that Chris could catch me is if we pick all of them differently. I go 0-7, he goes 7-0. But Chris, it's officially clinched because I also have the Boston Bruins. For the same reason, I don't think that the Jackets are going to go up 3-1. The energy in that building is fantastic, but to me, the Bruins are a better team. They can't afford to go down 3-1. I think they're in big trouble if they do. Game 4 is huge for them, and I think that they are going to even the series.
Another exciting game 4 is the Sharks traveling to Colorado once again. It was an exciting game 3. Nathan MacKinnon had a ridiculous goal. Logan Couture put up a hat trick. Only the 4th player in Sharks history to have a postseason hat trick. I'm going to go with the Avalanche in this one for the same reason. I don't think that they're going to go down 3-1 to the Sharks. I think the series, I picked the Sharks in six, but I think the way that these teams are playing right now will go seven. It seems to be every other game. They're just swapping who decides to win. I think this is the most exciting series, in my opinion, of the four going on right now. I'm going to go with the Avs.
I'm going to go with the Avalanche as well. I have them winning this series. They're at home. Honestly, I have Avalanche written down, but I might as well just start writing MacKinnon because he's been that good in this postseason for them. For that reason, I'm going to go with the Avalanche as well in game four.
Moving into the NBA, we're going to travel back to Boston, but this time it's for basketball. It's Milwaukee against the Celtics. Game three, first game at TD Garden in this series. The Bucks just look so dominant in game two. I don't think they're going to drop game three. They're going to ride that wave of momentum. Kyrie needs to step up, though. If the Celtics have any plan to win this series, it has to be on Kyrie Irving's back. But Giannis, you've talked about, I picked him as Defensive Player of the Year. You picked him as MVP. He's clearly a difference maker. I think for this game, he will be as well.
He's a difference maker for sure, and I also have the Bucks. Honestly, I kind of thought this series would go in the Bucks' favor pretty significantly, and I was surprised to see the Celtics win game one. I would be more surprised to see them take a lead later on in the series. So for that reason, at a 1-1 point, I will say that the Bucks go up 2-1.
Another exciting series in the East is the Raptors at the Sixers for a big game three. It's 1-1, so this will set the tone for who moves forward in this series. I picked the Sixers to win this series. So for that reason, I'll pick them in game three. You can't drop game three at home and expect to win the series. It's so hard to do. Both these teams, they're just so evenly matched. I could see this one going either way. This is, I think, my most exciting NBA series of the four right now, but I'll pick the Sixers for game three.
I would agree that it's also the most exciting right now. I'm going to take the Raptors. The Raptors were my pick. That's right. The Raptors were my pick to get to the NBA Finals to win the Eastern Conference. I stand by that, and I think that they'll get the edge here in game three.
Moving into baseball, some exciting series this weekend that I don't think going into the season people would have thought would have been so exciting, but here we are after a month, and they are exciting. It's going to start in the NL Central. The Cardinals will travel to the friendly confines of Wrigley Field for a three-game set. I will go with the Cubs in 2-1 in this series. The Cardinals are a good team right now, but it's hard to play at Wrigley. They just have kind of an annoying fan base, an annoying field. I don't like the Cubs at all. I do like the Cardinals, but I just think the Cubs have the upper hand in this series. I'm going to go with them 2-1.
I'm going to go with the Cardinals 2-1, not for any particular reason, just because these are two competitive teams. I think two teams that we'll see very much in the playoff picture when we get back in August, but for now I'm going to say that the Cardinals take 2 of 3.
I forgot my broom for this one, but the next series we're going to talk about is the Minnesota Twins and New York Yankees. It's a rematch of the wild card game from the 2017 season where the Yankees won that one. I think that they're going to have the brooms ready for Sunday for the sweep as they will beat Minnesota in all three games. Minnesota's had a very strong start, but they've played the Orioles in two series already, and the Orioles are awful, so that's kind of propelled Minnesota to the top of that division. The Yankees are the better team. They've done better, even with all the injuries they've had. I'm going to go with New York for that reason.
I'm going to go with the Yankees as well, but I'll say 2-1. I think the Twins can pull one out in there somewhere just because the Yankees have kind of had, by their standards or their expectations, an up-and-down start to the season. Both playing very well at the moment, but I'll go with the Yankees 2 out of 3.
And we always pick 7, and we're wondering, huh, another baseball game? Another NBA game, maybe? NHL? No, we are going to go to the USL. We're going to go home here with the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. This weekend, they are traveling down to play the Charleston Battery. The Hounds have had a rough start to the season. The Battery have had a little bit of a better start. For that reason, I'm going to go with Charleston in this game.
I'm going to go with the Battery as well. The Hounds just can't seem to find the right answers at the moment. They've got 4 draws of the 7 games that they've played. We aren't convinced that the goaltender that they're putting in is the right choice.
He's not.
I just think at the moment the Battery look like they're in a better position to win this weekend.
Yeah, watch out Duracell and Energizer because the Charleston Battery are coming. Last but not least, we have bowl predictions. We have 2 that we're going to say for the summer and moving forward, and then there's 1 longer term that will be come to fruition next year. Whether it's true or not, who's to say, but this point next year we will revisit this long-term one, but we're going to start with the short-term ones. I'm going to start in the MLB. It's Craig Kimbrel, one of the best closers in the game, currently does not have a team because for whatever reason free agency is dumb.
Oh, that's right.
And he is nowhere. I don't know why he's nowhere. Milwaukee lost Court Knebel. He's their closer. It's a match made in heaven. Craig Kimbrel needs to sign with the Brewers. I don't know when. Hopefully in May. I can't imagine him being a free agent into June still, but as it stands right now, he's a free agent. I think Milwaukee's the best fit. He will sign with the Brewers.
It's a good one. I like that one a lot. I'll go with Major League Baseball as well, and I will say that when we get back at the time of our first show of next season,
end of August,
yes, Major League Baseball's division leaders will be the Astros, Yankees, Indians, Cardinals, Phillies, and Dodgers. Most of those are pretty much what I expected at the beginning of the season to be in the postseason. For that reason, I think that they'll be there. They've all shown that they could potentially be there. I think the Cardinals can maybe be a stretch just because of how competitive the Central is, but those will be my six.
And that's actually a bold prediction because all six of these divisions are not led by these teams. Now we have the Twins in the AL Central, the Rays in the AL East. It's really wide open, so exciting to see how that works. My second prediction will stay in Major League Baseball. It will be the Los Angeles Dodgers. Cody Bellinger is doing nothing but slug the ball. By the time we get back the end of August, I think he will have 45 home runs to his name. He currently has 14, so he just needs 31 more in these next 3 to 4 months. So I think it might be a stretch, but he can get it done. He is just incredible right now. It's remarkable what he's done.
I like it. I'm going to go to the NHL. I'm going to say that in the Stanley Cup final this year, we will see two wildcard teams. All four of them are currently in action. I'm not going to say which two. I have an idea of which two, but I'm not going to put that on record. I'm just going to let it play out. And I'm going to say that it'll be a duel of the wildcard teams for the Stanley Cup.
Entirely off the record, would those two teams you think maybe be the Stars and the Hurricanes?
Entirely off the record, I think it's a possibility.
I just don't think it'll be the Blue Jackets, but Hurricanes, Stars, and even the Avalanche all seem like they're strong teams right now. I wouldn't be surprised. And the last one I have that we will revisit exactly 365 days from now, it will be in the NHL. The number one overall pick in the draft for 2020 will be announced by then. And for the, it seems like, 20th time in the last 10 years, I think the Edmonton Oilers will possess the number one overall pick. They are a team that has no idea what they're doing. But once again, being the worst team doesn't mean you have the best. You have the best odds, but doesn't mean you'll get it. We see the Devils have the number one pick this year. They are not the worst team, so anything's possible. And the Oilers, once again, can be looking at that draft board with big, wide eyes.
So I'm going to look at the 16 teams that are currently in action across the NHL and NBA. And I'm going to say that at the time of our last show next season, half or less than half of those teams will still be competing. And the reason that this is bold, I think, is because depending on how schedules fall, our last show could be during the first round, which could mean that some of these teams are already eliminated or maybe didn't even make the playoffs. So of the 16 teams currently still in action, I think at this time next year, half or less than half of them still will be in action.
That is exciting. That's definitely one we're going to have to write down, compare and contrast this year to last year. But I like both these. It'll be exciting to see how true or how incredibly false they come at this point next year.
Well, that is our time for tonight, and that is our time for the season. Thank you to everybody who has made our first season such a success, tuning in every week and listening to the podcast, and even following us on social media. Continue to do that over the summer. We will be posting about things that we will not be able to talk about until we see everybody again at the end of August, beginning of September. Thank you again, and have a great summer.
It's been a good 27 shows. Thank you for listening.